I've got my beverages in front of me. I'm ready to talk books. I'm ready to talk about Scout Notes. This is your first time listening to the show, Scout Notes, when we talk Scout Notes. It's casual thoughts of what I remember from listening to an audiobook. It's not extensive notes. It's just whatever comes to the top of my head, whatever's with me when I turn on the microphone. And the book we're doing is actually going to be our first work of fiction. So far, I have only done nonfiction. I'm going to do a book by Agatha Christie. And I've only read Agatha Christie once before, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which I love that book. That is an excellent book. This is a good book, but I don't like it as much as that one. And I'm not sure why, because all signs tell me that I should like this one more. And the reason I say that is because And Then There Were None, which was written in 1939, is, to this day, in 2023, the best-selling mystery novel of all time. Over 100 million copies. A lot of books. So I went into it wondering why. And I continued to examine it through that lens throughout the whole book. I don't often go into these episodes with a ton of notes in front of me, but I do write stuff down from my head so that I can keep things straight when I'm talking. And some of those details are the basic premise of the book, because I think it's important to understand the premise of the book before we really discuss it. The essential story here is 10 strangers are called to a mysterious island. And this island, it's an isolated island. You can only get to it by a boat once a day. Apparently it's small enough that all of the characters are clear that there's no way that anybody but them can be on the island. These are important details. And who are the characters? As I said, there are 10 of them. So we have a doctor. We have a retired general. We have an ex-British soldier who was an adventurer in Africa. We have a retired judge. We have, I guess, what you would call a reckless or irresponsible young man. Mild spoiler alert, but he's the first person to die. So you don't know a ton about him. And that happens pretty quick. So I haven't spoiled much. You have a religious woman. You have an ex-police inspector. You have a school teacher. And then you have a butler and his wife. And the wife is kind of assumed to be sort of the cook slash maid. So two servants. Now, I don't know about you, but the first thing that hit me as I started hearing these names, general, doctor, judge, I started to hear these roles of these characters. The first thing I thought of was the game Clue. And then I started to wonder, oh my God, am I reading the book that Clue, I don't want to say is based on, but is borrowing from? Clue is a murder mystery game where you have to solve who the murderer is. There's a butler in the game, but the butler is a non-playable character. He just kind of blocks you. This is the classic version of the game. I know this game has been redone many times. The butler kind of blocks your moves sometimes, but you can't play as the character, so the butler is not a suspect. In the movie version, which is a comedy and is actually pretty great and was pretty amazing for the time, what they did is they recorded three different endings. And so three different people were revealed to be the killer. And if you went to see it in a different theater, you would see a different ending. So you would think the murderer was somebody else. So nobody could spoil the movie because you don't know which version of the movie the other people were seeing. Pretty brilliant. So in the movie, the butler is a suspect. Then you have a maid in the game, Mrs. White. In the movie, they split Mrs. White into two characters. Mrs. White becomes an old widow. And then you have an additional character who's a maid, Yvette. I wrote down Yvette-er. She's a French maid, or I think a play off the French maid. I don't think, maybe she's not French. I don't remember. Then you have Colonel Mustard, which is kind of comparable to General in this case, in the book. Then you have Mr. Green, who was originally, in the first version of the board game, which was, it's a British board game, he was an Anglican priest, like a kind of a corrupt Anglican priest. And then when they brought it over to America, apparently they're like, no, that's not going to play. You got to change that. So they made Mr. Green into some sort of, to be honest, businessman, I think. In the movie, he becomes something completely different. I'll let you discover that on your own. Mrs. Peacock, who's what's referred to as a grand dame. You know, this is like a, comes from money, all about manners and propriety and so forth, which is kind of comparable to the religious woman in the book. Then you have Miss Scarlet. Miss Scarlet is a femme fatale. It's a trope from film noir and from detective novels of the dangerous but hot and sexy woman. Doesn't play so well to modern audiences, but that was a trope. And she's kind of, in a way, comparable to the school teacher. Not because the school teacher has much of that character, but they're just both the younger woman. And then you have Professor Plum, who's an academic, which I guess you can compare to maybe the doctor. So they're not direct comparisons here. So there's a reason for that. The reason the characters are not one-for-one comparisons, in one you have like seven characters, the game, six, if you remove the butler, who you can't play, and then you have 10. And that's because the person who created this board game was not trying to copy And Then There Were None. In fact, he was influenced by And Then There Were None by proxy. What I mean by that is Agatha Christie, in particular this book, but other books of hers as well, but in particular this book, influenced a genre that you may be aware of called murder mystery games or murder mystery dinners, where you go and we play out a drama and you have to try to figure out who the killer is, or you've probably seen it in TV shows. People have a party that's themed like this, and usually something goes wrong and somebody's really killed. That was Agatha Christie influenced that directly. And then the person who made the game, Clue, was influenced by these murder mystery games. So there's the detachment there. And then you have a difference in the plot. I haven't told you actually the plot of the novel. I've only told you the setup of the novel. And I haven't told you the purpose of the game. Some of you may know this already, but in the game, the original game, the house that everybody goes to is a house owned by a guy named Mr. Body. Little pun right there. The reason it's a pun is because Mr. Body is murdered. And the purpose of the game is to try to figure out who killed Mr. Body. There's also a play on words in the book. The person who invites everyone to the island, which nobody knows this person, but the name on all of the notes that they receive is U.N. Owen. So the initials U, the initial N, and then the last word or last name, Owen, O-W-E-N. And if you see it written, you realize that it's a play on unknown. So you have a similar pun going on there. But in the book, what's going on is these 10 people are slowly murdered. So first there are 10, this is a play on, And Then There Were None is a play off of a children's rhyme. There were 10, then there were 9, then there were 8, because that's what's going on here. They're slowly being picked off, which means after each murder, there's less suspects. And that's probably one of the things that stands out why this book is so fascinating to people, because think about how difficult it is to write that kind of book. You have 10 suspects, and now you have 9, and now you have 8. How do you keep people wondering who it is when you get down to 3, to 2, to 1? And I will tell you that you get all the way to the end before you know. Now, I say all that admitting that when I picked up the book, the first, you might experience the same thing. The first couple chapters, I was kind of like, meh. I wasn't sucked in right away. This isn't the kind of book that pulled me in right away. Maybe I was guilty of doing something we do when we read famous writers and we've read something of them before. I was caught in the game of comparing. So I'm listening to the book and I'm thinking, this isn't the same as Roger Ackroyd. At a certain point in the book, suddenly I realized, oh, I can't put this down. And I don't know where that happened. There isn't one moment where like one thing happens in the book and I was like, oh, I'm in. It's like it slowly wraps itself around you. And I'm going to admit something to you that maybe a lot of people will be surprised, since I'm doing an episode on this book. But I always promise to be honest. I was a bit disappointed with the ending. When I read it, I was really disappointed with it. Not because it wasn't executed well, not because it didn't make sense, because it did make sense, but just because it wasn't satisfying to me. And the more I've sat with the ending, the more I've realized, yeah, I guess that's a pretty good ending. I've liked it more, but it's still not as satisfying. Here, I'll do the comparison again. It's not as satisfying as Roger Ackroyd was for me. And I think part of the reason for that is about halfway through the book, I started, as most people do when they read mystery novels, the kind of the point of mystery novels generally is that you try to guess the ending. And I guessed an ending that I really liked. So maybe I was a little disappointed that it wasn't that ending. Not because I was worried about being right, but because it sounds like a pretty good ending. So I'm not going to tell you how the book ends, because that's for a mystery novel where you rely on the ending as the propelling force to get you through the book. That would be a crime. But I will tell you the ending that I wished. So you'll be hearing what is not the ending of the book. So all that means is when you read the book, you can't guess what I thought it was. But I think this would be a pretty great book. So you've got the 10 people. And what I didn't mention before is all of them are accused by UN Owen of a murder themselves or a crime themselves, that they've done something that they deserve what they're going to get. So what I thought would be really interesting, if you got to the end of the book and you find out that nobody was murdering these people, that the idea of being on the island and being faced with this judgment, that they all slowly killed themselves. That is not what happens, but that would be a really interesting book or a very interesting movie. So what I can say about why this book is as popular as it is, the reason, the conclusion that I've come to is that And Then There Were None is the best-selling mystery novel of all time because it's so innovative. And you might be thinking what I'm thinking, or what I was thinking before I came to that conclusion, which is where did he mention innovation? How is this innovative? You just compared it to a whole bunch of other things. Yes, I did. In fact, I have to make a reference now to a book that is going to be our next episode. I'm not going to tell you what the book is, but I will tell you that in the book, the topic of jazz comes up. And the author of this book mentions Louis Armstrong, the famous jazz musician. And he talks about how transformative, I can't even think of the right word here, groundbreaking, completely original and innovative Louis Armstrong was in jazz. Yet people listen to Louis Armstrong and they don't hear anything that surprises them. They don't hear that groundbreaking. And the reason for that is because he was so influential that everything came after him was influenced by him. So everything you've heard in jazz since Louis Armstrong in some way is almost always a reaction to Louis Armstrong. So Louis Armstrong's innovation has become commonplace to us because we hear it everywhere. So the only way that you could really appreciate how much Louis Armstrong changed jazz music and music in general is to go back and listen to nothing but jazz made before Louis Armstrong, and then go listen to Louis Armstrong and notice what a giant leap forward his music was. And in the same way, I think that's what we're dealing with when we talk about And Then There Were None. I mean, when you talk about the plot of, X amount of people stuck in one isolated place, slowly being picked off one by one, this is basically the plot of every slasher film ever made. The plot of this in some way has been played around with any show that in some way plays that mystery. Murder, She Wrote, and Psych probably did an episode like this. It's been done and done and done and done and done, plus the murder mystery shows, plus the board game Clue, plus all the other board games that are trying to be like Clue, plus all the video games that play off of those things. Everything smells of this. So it's hard to notice that this is really something innovative. But if you imagine that nothing like this was done before, then you understand. And to be honest, the reason it's popular is because it is hard to put down. It is really hard to put down. Now, coincidentally, something I picked up that I thought was going to be an audiobook that I was going to do an episode on was The Mysterious Case of Agatha Christie by Maureen Corrigan. And after I got about halfway through, I realized, oh, this isn't a book. This is an audiobook. It's if you go on Audible, you can buy things that were from the great courses. So it's essentially like a quote-unquote class, an audio class. So because it wasn't officially a book that people could go buy, I didn't do an episode on it. But I happened to listen to this just recently. And I think that's probably one of the reasons Agatha Christie moved to the top of my list. And one of the reasons for that is I actually started to sympathize very strong with Agatha Christie as a person, because here she is, this tremendously successful writer. And I don't mean just now. In her time, she was tremendously successful. In some ways, you could say she was the J.K. Rowling of her time. Just everybody knew her. Everybody had read her work. And at the same time, it's probably the same as any other popular author, critics weren't big fans. Some critics were not big fans of Agatha Christie. They said that her characters are barely two-dimensional, that they lack psychological depth, that they're just generalized types, you know, the doctor, the judge, the general. They're devoid of emotional depth, which there is depth in emotion here, but that their character lacks in complexity. Okay, I can't talk about everything that Agatha Christie did, but I will say this. Do they lack in complexity? To some degree, yes, in this book. Why? Not because Agatha Christie's a bad writer. Not because Agatha Christie didn't do the work to give these characters complexity, but because of the time constraint of the plot. We don't have time. You know, I mentioned the one character who's a reckless young man who's the first to die. We know almost nothing about him. Why? Because he's the first to die. There's no time to learn anything about him. And this isn't like a modern movie where you get the scene where they just info dump on you. Oh, let's do some research so we can tell the audience things we want them to know. What these people know and what they don't know is all we know. So is there a lack of complexity here? Yes, but because it would be ridiculous for her to go through and add complexity to these characters that couldn't happen in the constraints of the story that she's presenting. And so reading this, it actually fired me up because it made me angry. She is really being done a disservice. And these criticisms weren't just critics at her time. This is criticisms that people give still to this day. Oh, another one. Here's another funny one. They say that also she fails to show the effects of murder. That's kind of the whole point of the mystery genre. The mystery genre is not to make you feel the full effects that somebody's been murdered. That's what a drama is for. A mystery is about a mystery. Do these people need to go to therapy because they saw a dead body? This is a mystery. And when you read a mystery novel, it's a game you're playing. That's why it becomes a game, right? And the game is guess the end. This isn't meant to make you think like that. That's not the purpose of this kind of writing. So because of that, authors like Agatha Christie get compared to entertainment instead of literature. And Agatha Christie was super insecure about her writing because of that, and maybe even for reasons of her own. And what I'm reminded of is when Jack Kerouac became famous from On the Road, there was also another famous writer at the time who you probably heard of, Truman Capote. He wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's. He wrote In Cold Blood. His criticism after reading Kerouac was, that's not writing, it's typing. And that's because Kerouac did what's called spontaneous prose. He would sit at the typewriter and he would write long sentences. And what he was doing was trying to capture the energy of jazz in words, which I think he actually did. So these sentences were long and often unstructured, and words would be piled upon words because he's trying to get that the sound of the horn. He's trying to get that across with words. And Capote didn't get that. So I think when you see these exclusionary criticisms of people, you're like, oh, that's entertainment. That's not literature. That's typing, not writing. There's a word for that. It's called snobbery. And it's actually one of the things that I think about a lot in selecting books for this podcast, making sure to balance what some people would say highbrow, lowbrow, midbrow. I don't care about any of that stuff. As I've said before, I read for curiosity, not ideology. So I try to balance out that as much as I can. This is a fun book. This is a good book. Is it as serious as The Singularity Is Near by Ray Kurzweil? No. And it doesn't need to be. Just like it doesn't need to make you feel the full effects of murder. It's a freaking mystery book. Have fun with it. And when I think about this more, what makes me laugh is, in 100 years, what writers do you think people will remember? Who what names will still be in the public consciousness? Shakespeare, sure. Probably the first one that comes to mind. Probably the most likely. Charles Dickens, probably. Mark Twain, probably. Then after that, it becomes a guessing game. I think those three would come up on most lists. But you know whose names I think will show up on these lists as well? Agatha Christie and Stephen King. Two authors who write things that people don't credit enough and just throw into the bucket of entertainment. But they sell a lot of books and they wrote a lot of books. And because of that, they become part of the public consciousness. And this book has become part of the public consciousness as a trope. The trope of the people slowly being picked off. Even the trope of the people going to one place and having to find who the murderer is. Which is basically every single episode of Murder, She Wrote and shows like that. So I think it's time that we give Agatha Christie credit. Not as a fun, entertaining writer, which she was, but as someone who did a lot for writing in general, who contributed a lot. Someone that I think wrote literature. To me, this is mystery literature. And if you read this and you like this, then you have to go read The Murderer of Roger Ackroyd, because I like that even more than I like this book. I'm glad you guys came back again. I hope that you are subscribing to the show. Should be on all the major podcast platforms. I've said this before. I'm going to repeat this at every episode. The link for the book and any other links, relative links that I think you should check out will be in the notes or the description of the episode in your podcast player. But if you really enjoy the show, go to creativeisolation.substack.com and become a paid subscriber, because when I go into the deep dive episodes, where I go long on a book and I actually have extensive notes, when I've actually sat down and read the book with my eyeballs, gasp, those episodes will only be available to paid subscribers, as well as anytime I cover a book that may be considered controversial. I will do that for paid subscribers only. I am not a dancing monkey. I am not here for spectacle. So make sure you do that. Make sure you go over to creativeisolation.substack.com and also just become a subscriber to get the free newsletter. I enjoy writing it every week. It's about the creative process. It's about life. Sometimes it's about cat farts. Go over there and subscribe. And then also, if you're interested in seeing what my fiction writing is like, I have a deconstructionist fiction project that I'm doing as a separate Substack called The Thing That Devours Everything. There will be a link for that in the description as well. And lastly, I have created a list of the books that we've covered so far. Not a big deal now since we've only done 4 books, but as this grows, it will be a place where you can go and find the books. They'll be in alphabetical order, easier to find, and then you can go and check them out and go back and listen to episodes, find it easier that way, or also go and buy the books, which anytime you buy a book, it's going to support the show as well. So go read a book.